Hey there, folks. Glad you're back. Just in case you missed it, I'm Nate Bennett. This is the sixth episode of Shuffleptic, my autobiographical podcast series. Subjects discussed in this episode include injury that may or may not result from the after effects of seizures, how others view those of us who have seizures both before and after they witness what we're really dealing with, lasting physical impacts caused by my episodes, and my own first go-around with the official American disability deciding machinery. If you find this episode interesting or possibly even informative, and or you know someone who might also, tell them about it. It's free, so they'll pay no fee. Chapter 17.
The Finger.
It's weird how seizures have this trickle-down effect. What I mean is, the brain itself doesn't have the same kind of hurts that the rest of the body does after seizures, but it clearly has been hurt in these ways that are sometimes obvious and sometimes subtle and extended over time. If I had injured some part of my body during a grand mal, I'd feel it as I gradually got consciousness back. And if I'd injured more than one part of my body, I'd gradually feel them all. So, if I had bruises or cuts or bites or whatever happened during the episode, I'd gradually size them up or triage them based on how much they hurt or how dangerous they might be. Then, I'd treat them, wrap them up, figure out how to conceal them if possible, and keep on a rolling until they got better. What else could I do? There's just not the same flavor of pain for the brain, but it controls everything else. So, when I had been smacked around a bit or maybe suffocated whatever amount during the ordeals, I would come back cloudy, forgetful, and clumsy. At first, I'd misjudge distances with my eyes, on top of being unable to get hands to open or legs to take their usual length of strides. Sometimes, I'd miss if I reached for something or clunk and bump into stuff notably more than I would have before the seizure had happened. And of course, I'd also have memory issues, which usually improved gradually after episodes, but with more and more seizures, this recovery was less and less complete and took longer and longer. There were also external influences, the things that had to do with how other people viewed me rather than just my own self-contained issues. I was more likely to find myself embarrassed, forgetting a name here and there, or forgetting to return a call. And then I had to be careful to limit how much I exposed my problems to some people, like the people I was working with, for example. After all, I had good reason to be paranoid that if I was a little too clumsy or forgetful, I might, for example, lose my job. I couldn't help but have these recovery problems pointed out to me in two major areas of activity in my life, while working and while playing music. After my seizures, playing music can be really hard, especially at first. I'll have to deal with anything from dropping guitar picks too easily to not being able to get all my limbs to work together at the drum kit. Add to this the fact that I might have forgotten any amount of time, which directly affects being able to remember what music I was rehearsing or writing as well. And since I've spent so much time working on music through my life, I'm a harsh critic of myself. I often find that I put instruments down quickly after picking them up until I've finally gotten my hands to at least start following simple orders. Eventually, my brain starts doing a little better in the memory department, so I'll start to have at least some enjoyment by playing a little until I'm where it's as good as it's going to get, even though it can still feel like a regular cycle of taking two steps forward followed by 2.5 steps back. At work, I was also likely to notice my shortcomings as I recovered from events in both the physical and mental aspects. Unfortunately, sometimes others could also see them too. As a chef by trade, meaning I did not get formal training, I was the manager of a kitchen, not only in terms of its food, but also in terms of its workers. I had to handle the business end and keep it solid. I had to deal with any and all staff-related issues, and I usually had to cook, too. But when you've been in kitchens as long as I have, you already know you'll be dealing with all of these duties when you apply for a kitchen management job and that everyone will be coming to you for every damn answer as you're chopping up whatever simultaneously. Knowing I would be under this kind of regular pressure daily, let's just say I was very motivated to get my shit back together as quickly as I could after I had any episode, whether anybody else had seen it happen or not. And while I was chopping along with whatever distractions, I could often tell if I wasn't quite recovered yet. These reaching and gripping problems, along with whatever nervous sort of shaking or tired muscles, would stand out to me right away when I first picked up a knife. How could they not? I was so in tune with knives after years spent at cutting boards that the slightest residual effects on my hands and arms were immediately obvious. This is the realm where more after effects trickle down. Like, for instance, when I almost chopped off the top third of my left middle finger because of a stupid, rushed knife move at work. Strangely enough, it happened the day after Bri had chopped a big chunk off his left index finger knuckle while hacking corn at his job. When we talked about it years later, he reminded me that I'd apparently lectured him and told him how that was a dumb move and that he should have been paying more attention. A nice, hypocritical Big Brother lecture. But I got to eat my words on that one. When I cut my finger, I was working a normal day at the homeless center and running around like I did every day. I used the knife in a way that made me warn myself not to, but it was already too late. My bad judgment won that brief conflict. The food I had in front of me with the knife stuck in it somehow slid away, and a millisecond later there was a cut across the back of my left middle finger, just behind the first knuckle. Blood, of course, started flowing quickly, but the thing that tripped me out was how the tip of my finger immediately bent at a 90-degree angle and I could not straighten it at will. Now I would be learning firsthand about a condition known as hammer finger. This happens when one of the tendons in a finger gets sliced through and the tendon opposing it contracts without opposition. I grabbed it immediately with the other hand and held it straight. So then, in December of 2002, I got to visit that same emergency room once again. My finger was stitched up and positioned into a splint that started at the tip of my finger and was wrapped all the way down to my wrist. At the tip of my finger, the splint was shaped to keep the finger together by keeping tension off of the wound by pointing it upward, opposite the way the finger usually bends. This whole package was wrapped up from one end to the other with bandages, and I was told to follow up with the specialist. I don't think I had any seizures while trying to heal that wound. I do know that it started to hurt a couple of days later, though. It hurt more and more and more until I had to admit something must be wrong. I lifted the part of the splint that was covering my palm and saw that a red line was now creeping up to my wrist. Infection. Once again, my bro took me in to deal with an emergency. The ER told me I would have to have an emergency surgery immediately and sent me to a hand surgeon. When that doctor unwrapped my hand, my middle finger had bloated up like a cooked bratwurst all the way to the injury area where it was constricted by tape. From there to the tip, it was tiny, white, and shriveled. The doctor who treated it was really worried about giving me any kind of painkiller, local or general, for fear that it might interact with my seizure medication. I know now that at least local anesthetics are not usually a problem, though knocking me out totally can be. But since he couldn't reach my neurologist, he figured it would have to be dealt with without using any painkillers to numb what he was doing. I guarantee that using a local would have been safer. The pain was immense as he milked the horrible-smelling pus out of the finger, squeezing it over and over while he apologized repeatedly, saying in a calm voice, "I'm so sorry. I know this must really hurt. I'm really sorry about this." That calm voice, the smell that was going on, and some serious pain all added up to some really medieval memories. No wonder they've stayed with me. I guess I had been hosting a staph infection, which is a very common basic type. I was told after the milking fun was over that if I had waited just a few hours longer to get help, I probably would have lost some or all of the finger. Wow, that would have really been a drag. I mean, this is probably my second favorite, sometimes first favorite, guitar string finger on that hand. By the time it had healed up, I'd permanently lost about half of the motion at that knuckle. Basically, I can't straighten it fully, which most of the time is no biggie, but I did have to figure out how to reposition some things to play strings and keys, and it took a while to get used to typing again. Now I have a funky callus at that end of the finger and a big scar across the top, but hey, I can still play and type, and I'm still alive to use it, right? Thing is, with an injury like this one, it's not possible for me to know if the seizures actually caused it, especially this far down the road and looking back. It seems kind of pointless to obsess over it, but somehow, I can't help but consider that finger to be one of the permanently injured veterans of the bigger war I've now been fighting for years. Chapter 18.
Looks fine to me.
Disability, in terms of how it actually impacts your working status, happens here in this country when your employer questions whether or not you are able to keep doing your job safely and tells you to get your doctor to write whatever note for them that says you can, or if not, when you will be able to, or if you can, but only if whatever accommodations are made, either while you are recovering or permanently. Then, you go see your doctor that says whether or not you can or cannot do whatever at your job as it is described. If your doctor doesn't think you can work, you can try going to another doctor, but if they and however many more doctors agree, eventually you have to realize that nobody wants to put their name on the paper saying you are all good to keep doing your job. Now, if your employer and your doctor didn't agree about whether or not you can do the job, you can try to argue your ability to keep working, but most often they do agree. Keep in mind, the world is full of terrible accidents and situations that cause people to lose body parts and stuff, and now since they are missing whatever limbs or are paralyzed or whatever, they clearly just can't keep doing the same job. Sometimes, in those situations, the employer will work with the employee to put in a ramp at an entrance or even to change the duties of the job to accommodate the disability, but often it's outwardly obvious that someone just can't do what they were doing before. In my situation, I've often appeared to be totally fine from the outside, and unless I've had a seizure recently, you just wouldn't guess that I have any problems at all. Thing is, my seizures don't happen all the time. It's just that when they do, they can be real nasty. And when people hear my story, unless I'm still clearly beat up from a recent round or I'm actually having a seizure, they hear it kind of like, I've got this Uncle George that's got a stuffed antelope or something. And most people's response is something like, oh, really? I've heard of that. Must be a drag. Sip the teacup and gaze out the window. So, you were saying you have some kind of problem then? Sure, of course. We all have something wrong with us, right? But when somebody's actually seen it happen, actually seen me go off, all of a sudden there's an interesting change because they believe me now. And all of a sudden they start asking if I'm okay and what they can do and if there's anything they can do and how they can help me keep it from happening again and whatever and on and on and on. For me, time has skipped forward by some amount if I've had a seizure, but whatever happened during the part I missed has somehow convinced the person that this shit is for real and that there is no way I could have just faked whatever they witnessed. It's not a situation that can be remedied by installing a ramp. And people always act surprised once they see it happen, no matter how much I've warned them about myself in advance. Usually, people I've been working with immediately start regularly inquiring about how I'm feeling and if I've eaten recently, and sometimes they even remind me to take my medications. They care now. They're on my side now. It's a real sweet thing to see the transition happen. I believe that most folks are usually good at heart and would want to help out if they could, and that's really something to smile about. I've learned to try to welcome the support of other people in my world, to answer the questions they start asking, listen to whatever they've just read or heard about seizures, hear about other people in their lives that have whatever medical issues, you know. I try to make sure folks don't feel however guilty for not taking my condition super seriously. They just didn't really know how serious of a situation it really is until they've seen what it does, and now they do. For crying out loud, it certainly took me long enough to get enough respect for it. Chapter 19.
Impacts. Seen and subtle.
Now I'll get around to some of the real-life physical impacts of my seizures when they do happen. As I'm writing this now, I'm proud to say I've made it through a lot of seizures, though I always hope to never have more. I'm pretty sure that I've had well over 100 full-size seizures, which have gradually gotten more severe over the years. It's impossible to put an exact number on how many I've had, especially because I usually don't remember everything, but after a while I began to keep a journal. Even with its help, I know I can't possibly have listed them all. Apparently, I'm an odd case in a number of ways from the perspective of the world of medicine and its statistics. I basically have really sporadic episodes that are exceptionally dangerous, but in between, I get back up and keep on ticking. I've officially been diagnosed as having a rare type of seizure disorder rather than having good old-fashioned epilepsy. This designation has to do not with how dangerous I may be to myself and to others around me during and after my episodes, but is also about how frequently my episodes occur. It's also been officially explained to me that I don't actually have plain old grand mals when I do have big ones. I have something medically designated as secondary generalized seizures. I guess this is because when I have the aura or spell part of a seizure, a small part of my brain is starting to freak out. And if it freaks out more areas of my brain, I do the whole convulsing type thing. Really, this is something I don't bother telling anyone if I'm explaining that I have seizures, for the same reason that I don't designate that I have a seizure disorder rather than epilepsy. Most of us don't know the difference, and it's best and easiest for me to use the terms more people are familiar with. As far as the impacts my seizures have caused, first of all, there's the gradually growing list of physical injuries. As I explained earlier, I have that situation going with my back, caused by falling full force onto my butt, and it's worsened over time since it was first diagnosed. While I was studied at Stanford, I actually thrashed so damn hard during a grand mal that the doctors and staff told me they were able to hear it crack loudly, even though I was firmly strapped into a bed. The goal at that time was to intentionally trigger a seizure so that data could be collected and analyzed, and I'm pretty sure they recorded video of this, collected as part of the study, but I didn't exactly ask to watch it. Some memories I can do without, I suppose. For a long time, as I healed up from that adventure, I had to take it more seriously, because I had a sort of weak spot where my back had literally been broken, and it sort of had two positions I could maintain. One was like I had a stick up my butt and was being inspected by a drill sergeant. I could also snap with an audible clunk into the other position and would then be like a hunchback with my posture sagging completely. Making this transition didn't usually hurt, but sometimes I'd like pinch something and then I'd become pretty useless for a while because however I'd move my torso, I'd get a stab of pain severe enough that sometimes I would inhale and gasp no matter how hard I'd try to keep the pain to myself. The team at Stanford helped me out by fabricating a back brace for me. Now I can use it both to recover from this situation and to prevent it from being aggravated if I know I'm going to be doing some bending or lifting. It's a really helpful tool to have. While I was recovering from that seizure at Stanford, I remember being in the bed and starting to work on getting over the back pain by thinking about how when I got home, I was going to start doing sit-ups and crunches until I had a solid torso that could support these dang brittle bones. When I talked with the specialist at Stanford about the injury, though, I was told I have to actually not do the whole macho man thing. Apparently, the situation is now that the injury is there permanently, and the bones just aren't going to have the relationship they were designed to have. So basically, repeating whatever motions will actually be wearing the area out rather than helping to support it. And apparently, I'll have to keep that in mind and be careful not to aggravate it for the rest of my life. So there's the back thing. Lately, most of the time I've managed to keep it okay, and it only rarely surprises me with the pinch problem. Of course, I've not been out splitting much wood yet, but when I have to do chores like that, I'll start by putting on that brace. Next up on the damage list would probably be the mouth. It's been a war zone over the years. I've always done a decent job with the brush and floss habits and all, but I've busted up my teeth in a number of ways over time. Now, I've got no teeth at all on like the back third of my right side, and I've got numerous bridges and crowns keeping a chewing line together on the left. I managed to get my broken front teeth covered with these fancy porcelain crowns, but then I started to break the crowns off bit by bit as I developed a sort of vampire look for a while. Thankfully, the same dentist saw me for years in California and helped me out by re-crowning them as time went on. Damage to teeth can always be caused by crunching them together over and over or from falling, like falling from a standing position and landing on my chin, and even by hitting objects directly. But usually, a seizure heavy enough to cause dental damage will also have taken its toll on the soft parts of my mouth as it happened, including biting the insides of my cheeks and, of course, biting the hell out of my tongue. It is really hard to reconcile the whole tongue deal during recovery. Eating anything hurts, sometimes really badly, and disturbs the injury I know I am trying to heal. And I can't just get around eating by using a straw or drinking smoothies or whatever, because ingesting anything means moving that damn tongue somehow. Granted, some things go down easier than others, but having harsh wounds on my tongue has repeatedly pointed out to me just how much and how often that muscle does its work, like most of us would never likely realize. And repeatedly, I've also felt how this has slowed down my recoveries because it's made it damn hard to get the very nutrition that I know I need to get myself better. Looking at it in a mirror makes it hurt worse, but I always look. And when I look, I can't help but get pissed at myself for doing that to myself again. Why would I do this to myself? And then I immediately hit the "don't get pissed at myself, it's not my fault" reflex, which still isn't as good as not getting mad about it in the first place. Next on the itemized damage list, it appears that the swan dive face plants may have actually had a lasting impact after all, though I had thought the black eyes and bruises were just temporary. Now keep in mind, I'm a little over 6 feet tall, and what we are sometimes talking about here are injuries often caused by full-blown falls from standing height. Sometimes I've fallen from even higher than that because I've been on something when it's happened, like when I was on my loft ladder and let go. Also, oddly, I apparently sometimes have been known to get a running start as I start to lose consciousness, but I'm still trying to stay on my feet, causing me to try to outrun the falls, but I still have fallen anyways. I'm pretty sure this is where I've picked up some crazy, like, face rug burn type scuffs and bruises I've pondered over later. Thing is, apparently over time when I've gotten a bloody nose out of the deal, I may actually have been breaking it or re-injuring it, which has basically caused scar tissue to build up inside that partially blocks my nasal passages, mostly on the left side. Because of this, I've now been diagnosed with obstructive sleep apnea, or OSA. Now what goes on is I don't quite breathe deeply enough to empty my lungs fully while sleeping, which causes my reflexes to make me snap awake and take a deeper breath, like 40 or 50 times a night. This was first noticed when doctors examined the data that had come from the 150 leads that were implanted in my head for 2 weeks during the final phase of the study at Stanford. Getting diagnosed, then educated about this, was the first step in managing the situation. I gave the CPAP face mask machine that was prescribed to try for several months. And though it was a nice and very advanced machine, Amy and I found that at least for the moment, the ends just didn't justify the means. See, that's part of the deal with some of these kinds of external treatments when you have another person around. They don't just impact the person being treated, and patients may have to realize how others will be affected also as they weigh their options. Now, I've learned that I basically do best when I sleep on my back or on my sides. I never sleep on my stomach. This not only seems to cause me to breathe best, but it also lessens the odds that I could suffocate if I had a seizure during sleep. You see, there's yet another hard way that seizures can impact a person's lives: by ending them. This is the classification known as SDE, sudden death in epilepsy. It's generally acknowledged that 3 to 4 million people have epilepsy in the USA as I write this, and if you have seizures, you have between an 8% and 17% likelihood of dying this way. You just start seizing as usual, but it happens when you're between covers or pillows or something and you just don't manage to get your air. That, or maybe your heart rhythm gets messed up too badly. SDE doesn't always happen because of suffocation. Sometimes seizures seem to just plain cause death, but being educated and planning ahead can lessen the likelihood of this outcome. Now, I don't scare myself with these kinds of numbers constantly, but as I have realized more and more the true brevity of my condition, I've done all I can to save up whatever tips I can collect to keep on rolling. I know also that getting a good night's sleep is a big part of both preventing and recovering from seizures, so if my OSA worsens or if I'm not sleeping, I may yet again end up in the stormtrooper mask. I hope not, for both myself and my wife's sake, but I'll do what I gotta do. I'm not exactly getting awesome sleep at the moment, but I am back in what appears to be my usual cycle of letting my internal desire to accomplish something meaningful make me wake up and get busy because the pressure is on. It's that pressure that's driven me to write this book, and this kind of reaction to the pressure that seems to be much more like the old me, from what I can tell anyway. The old Nate used whatever he had around him to get a job done, and that's what I seem to be doing now. So, a little sleep issue appears to be the last of the major long-lasting physical effects as of now. Oh, of course there's the pills. I currently have to take 3 kinds twice a day, and I've been told right from the beginning that I would be having to do that for the rest of my life. They make me a little sleepy sometimes, and I don't enjoy drinking alcohol at all anymore because the combo isn't fun. But they, of course, each have their own list of possible impacts on your body that can be long-lasting. One of my meds basically can make you lose bone density, and I apparently now rate just below the line that would be considered osteoporosis. To address this, I have to take vitamins daily. All of the pill swallowing is no big deal. How to actually keep them coming to me is on my mind a lot more often than all of the direct physical effects are. See, that's a very effective motivator, because unless I'm extra careful about doing it, stopping any of these pills can cause withdrawal seizures, just like that poor old drunk guy I told you about outside the homeless center was having. I've had this proven to me over the years, because even when my intention wasn't to skip my meds, just going through some regular old life-triggered vomiting has set me off enough times that I've learned to realize that if I puke at any point, I'd better fasten up them seatbelts because here it comes. It's been a similar situation when I've had fevers. Over the past decade or so, pretty much any time I've gotten a basic flu bug or had whatever issue make me get hot and/or vomit, I've then also had clusters of seizures. And one of the important concepts I've had to learn is that when a person in my situation has a seizure, they are more likely to have more of them. The less often they have them, the less likely they are to have them. Simple enough. Chapter 20,
my SS debut.
Well, I've now been there and done that enough to realize that when a seizure is happening, the brain is somehow allowing itself, or tricking itself into slipping into sort of a glitch or loop that does not benefit its own well-being or allow it to use its own internal life-continuing mechanisms to proceed as usual so it can simply keep staying alive as its first priority. It's like the record started to skip, and the more times it skips, the more the defect is being reinforced, increasing the likelihood that it will keep skipping. To me, it is a suicidal stumbling glitch routine that my brain has learned from way back before I'd ever remember. It seems like once your brain knows how to glance at the big door, it's only easier to look back at it. And you can find yourself getting stuck in this routine until you wake up yet again after an undetermined length of time figuring out the next new round of where you are and what's a-going on. Somewhere around the time after I had that 3-day round of seizures, lost about 6 weeks of memory, and finally had lost my job, I first learned from one of my doctors that my condition was very severe and that I may never be able to work again. I was then in my early 30s, and just like everybody else around me, I'd been thinking of myself as being just fine, except for maybe every now and then. At that point, though, it was time for me to step up and face the big, cold machinery that applies the official stamp of permanently disabled in our country. That's when I began my first go-around with the United States Social Security system. During it, I learned much, but admittedly, forgot plenty. Years later, I went through my old paperwork to piece together again what all had happened, because I've consistently had trouble being able to remember many details of that stretch of time, and a lot of that not lovely experience had, perhaps thankfully, disappeared from my memory. I do remember enough to know very well that it was an insulting shit show that made me, a tax-paying, system-feeding, hard-working American citizen, feel like I was guilty until I had proven myself innocent and that I failed to do that well enough and finally had given up, just like the machinery clearly wanted me to do. Later on down the road, I, unfortunately, had to go through a second round with them, which required that I review and reorganize all kinds of medical records from my past. Somewhere along the way, I had made a folder on my computer desktop called SS. I had gotten so tired of typing out SOCIAL space SECURITY a million damn times that I had just started labeling all related files with SS in their names because I'd know what that meant and I would be able to find them later if I had to. Of course, this had nothing to do with any kind of oppressive Nazi regime references that some might infer from these initials. Right. I know that I had gotten some legal advice before that first round, and had been informed that based on what I had been told by my doctors up to that point, I should go ahead and apply for Social Security disability benefits. The logic was that, for one thing, there was no reason to think that the seizures would be cured, so I'd likely have them for the rest of my life. Also, as it still is now, the system's always so backed up that it could have taken a year or more to get a decision, and then it was likely that I'd have to appeal that decision up to 4 times, which could take years. So applying then was a sooner is better situation, even if I really wanted to return to work. What you're doing when you apply for Social Security disabled status is telling them that you have a medical disability that prevents you from working in your customary line of work and that this is not going to change. Therefore, you are asking to get paid the same money that you would otherwise be waiting to get when you reach retirement age, when they begin to send you checks every month based on what you've been feeding into the system as you've had that little slice taken out of all your paychecks during your working years. When you attempt to get disabled status, you are just asking for that retirement age line to be moved up, more or less, because you are asking for access to the same money from the same machine, just sooner than you would have had you not become disabled. You are trying to retire early, because your doctor has told you that you can't work, whether you want it to be that way or not. Bummer is, both back then and now, the American Social Security system really is bogged down. And no matter how crazy it has been to jump through all the hoops that this system's thrown in front of me, I've come to recognize that it's not any one person's fault. That's why any time I've had to deal with someone on the phone or in their office, no matter how tempted I've been to get furious, I've tried to remember to visualize what that person's dealing with. I've tried to take a deep breath and see myself as just another case in front of whoever's working in that giant system that's just trying to make their own living. None of them built the machine. They're all just gears turning within it. They're under pressure to weed out all the illegitimate cases that get plopped in front of them, and sadly, it's most of them. So, with that being their daily working background atmosphere, I naturally had to expect that they'd take a look at my case and stamp it with rejected, which they did, of course. This wasn't a quick rejection to get, to begin with. When you apply for Social Security Disability Insurance Benefits, SSDI, you have to have already used up 6 months worth of short-term disability, SDI, which more or less is the same barrel you get fed from if you become unemployed. That's a state-level machine that you are also feeding with deductions from your paychecks as you work. It's just that this smaller system is in the hands of the state you live in, rather than Social Security, which is operated by the federal government. So, when you become unemployed due to a disability, you are in the same boat you'd be in if you got laid off. Soon you begin to get regular checks in the mail, but they are much smaller than the ones that you were earning when you were working. The federal system says you've got to drink up that juice box first, then come see them and apply if you still think you're disabled. And don't think that means that they start paying you. You'll have to win your approval, and if when you do, you'll be back paid to the point when you applied. But until you win your permanently disabled status, you're on your own. In my case, when I first was told I was disabled, doctors had restricted me from working with any sharp tools or near any hot surfaces, near any stairs or possible high fall situations like ladders and loading docks, driving, operating any machines, you name it. And I had been told this was not going to change. So working any job I had ever done was now off limits. Worse, I learned that if I got caught doing any work, including any duties within these restrictions my doctors had listed, I could blow my chance to apply for SS again for my disability forever. So it was officially not time for me to work, at least not doing anything I had ever done, like using, let's say, tools or any other dangerous type stuff. But I had to work. I just knew I could not do it on the table. So I had to take whatever jobs I could do for cash so I could pay my bills and eat. If I had to explain this to a judge today, even if I might be getting myself locked up forever for whatever terrible list of federal crimes I might have committed back then, I'd have to confess that I just plain fucking had to work to stay alive. And work I did. Work that was far more dangerous than the kitchen work I had always done before. Usually gutting old houses for remodeling, standing on ladders with a sawzall while reaching out to cut down old shit that was falling all over. When the SS system first puked me out, I was referred to the Department of Rehabilitation of Santa Cruz County for assessment and vocational rehabilitation. This means the big system said no and referred me back to the local system so I could get evaluated for my abilities and maybe even guided into a job that I could do with my disability. And boy, it definitely helped nice people spend nice time and nice money not helping me a fucking bit. I had forgotten about the bizarre combo of experiences that side trip had entailed until I opened up my old book of records. Turns out, this facility, located just a couple blocks from my old job at the homeless center, had referred me first to a neuropsychologist for an evaluation, which apparently took 2 long appointments worth of numerous tests to complete. I found a copy of the report this doctor had made, and it was kind of a trip to review, I must admit. Next, with this report in hand, the rehabilitation counselor that was handling my case had to evaluate me over a 5-day stretch and then make another report as well. This report was to determine aptitudes, interests, and strengths, limitations and required accommodations, transferable skills, and 4 feasible job goals. It resulted in a big list of different career examples I might have been able to consider because the evaluation had proven I could handle them. Wow! Turns out I could have been a sausage maker, or a park naturalist, or a radio and television announcer, or a number of other wonderful career jobs which were supposedly within my skill set. Seriously, all of these jobs would have been just fine with me at that point. Next, the rehabilitation counselor had then considered the restrictions listed by my doctor, including my being unable to drive, and this very much narrowed down the options. So I was then guided to a job, the only job that I would supposedly be able to do from the giant list of positions that they would supposedly have been able to help me find in the area. Next, they had to do a live scan to make sure I had a clean background to do this job. And this is what they came up with. When all planets had finally aligned, I could be a substitute custodian for the county school district, but only when I would be able to work shifts that I could reach by using the local bus system. So, this meant if a custodian working for the Santa Cruz County Public School District was feeling sick and knew that they were already sure that they were going to call out the following day, I'd be on the list of subs that could be contacted to cover the shift, but only if the bus could get me there and back for it, which was not most of the regular shifts. What can I say? I was playing their game, asking what system was in place to deal with me and seeing if it really could help me find work. After I had waited like a month and got absolutely 0 custodian substitution work, I finally told my counselor that I was going back to the kitchen, where at that time I had already worked for like 17 years, because I was then doing work that was more dangerous than any kitchen work to get by, and I knew it was safer than many of the things I was actually doing for cash. I had followed the orders, I had filled out the papers, I had waited in the lines in reception areas, and I had snuck in whatever work I could find around the edges. I was working, after all, and I was tired of hiding it. I was not raised to be either lazy or a chronic liar, and enough was enough. Somehow, after I had explained this, I was then officially allowed to return to my customary work in the kitchen. And I did so. Soon I found a nightclub that had just opened in Santa Cruz. One of the 3 owners was a medical doctor, and he listened to my story as he interviewed me and realized that he could get a pretty darn experienced manager at a darn reasonable salary if they could just basically look the other way every now and then if I happened to flip out. I was fortunate to have this understanding. He not only empathized with how ridiculous and frustrating of a year I had just gone through as the system chewed me up and spit me out, but he also knew enough as a doctor to understand that I had the spell to warn me if I started to seize, and he knew the critical role this could play in keeping me and those working around me safe if I did go off while working. Unfortunately, like so many startup businesses, for many reasons, the place couldn't sustain itself and it closed within about 1.5 years. Like much of this time period, I know this mostly because I've done that whole research thing more so than because I have normal working memories. Thank God I've saved boring stuff like resumes, emails, and old menus and prep sheets and a few pictures from the jobs I've worked along the way. More than once now, the pictures have made me realize how many great folks I've worked both for and with. And if by any chance any of you happen to be reading or hearing this, I didn't mean to forget you. Please don't take it personal. It seems like there's still a chance I might get the memories back, and I really do want them back. This concludes episode 6 of Chefaleptic. Episodes are posted weekly on Mondays. I plan to leave all of them on my site for its full 3-year contract, and hopefully even longer, so they can be revisited or even binged on whenever convenient. All music used in this series is original. This time, at the beginning, I used music from a song called The Drums of Victory from my 2020 project Better Next Times, and this here wild and crazy jam came from a tune called Pointless from the heavy portion of my 2017 album Tough Lucky. If you ever think you might like what you're hearing or want to check out more of my music, you can both hear and download plenty of it for free here at natebnt.com, and it's also gracing cyberspace at numerous free music sites. A blog, printed version of this series is also posted for those who'd prefer to read, and new episodes are posted weekly as well. For a sources cited reference list, go to the end of the episodes in the blog section. I'll be making an ongoing effort to make sure these lists are as complete and accurate as possible. This week, I did not cite any sources as the episode is based only on my personal history, but I did include some tips and links in this area that may be useful. Till next week, bounce back, stay bright, keep resilient, and be free.